The students invited me to talk on does evolutionary theory disprove Christianity? And if I wanted to, I could make that a really short lecture. That might be good. It would go something like this. Does evolutionary theory disprove Christianity? Nope. And that's it. That's over, huh? But the Thomistic Institute might not be pleased with something quite that short. So I'll try something a little longer, but longer is always a little bit dangerous when it comes to lectures, especially a lecture on a broad topic like evolution and Christianity. But we'll try it. But I'll first give you a few ideas about where this lecture is headed. So suppose we start with evolution. If we do that, I think we'll soon find that the apparent conflict between Christianity and evolution doesn't spring from the theory of evolution or the science of evolution, but from certain accretions that have happened to that that seem to deny God's providence. We might also find that those accretions are not the product of science as such, but an ideology known as scientism. And then if we turn to Christianity, we might find it's not Christianity as such that may clash with the theory of evolution, but certain brands of Christianity, perhaps creationism. And perhaps we'll find that just as scientism, in the guise of evolutionary science, seeks sometimes to disprove Christianity, so creationism, in the guise of Christianity, tries to disprove the theory of evolution. Finally, in this talk, I'll offer you a way, I think, I hope, of reconciling the theory of evolution with the Christian doctrine of divine providence using, guess who, Thomas Aquinas, and his theology. And we might find that God's providential action in the world not only is not excluded by, but actually is required for the phenomenon of evolution. So we begin with the science of evolution. And as you notice on this handout that you have, there are different titles in italics on the side here, just so you don't lose hope. You can see we're progressing through as we move down the outline. On the back, oops, on your flip side, you'll see a kind of a diagram that we'll use at the end of this presentation. Okay. Evolution. We begin with a brief review of that science. And we'll use Charles Darwin himself and the summary that he presents in his key work on the origin of species. And as you listen, you might take a glance at the bullet points there and see if you spot the chief elements of his theory. He says, "It's interesting to contemplate an entangled bank on a riverside, clothed with many plants of many kinds, birds singing in the bushes, and reflect that these elaborately constructed forms, so different from each other, have all been produced by laws acting around us. These laws, taken in the largest sense, being growth with reproduction, inheritance, variability, a ratio of increase so high as to lead to a struggle for life, and as a consequence to natural selection, entailing divergence of character and the extinction of less improved forms." So from the war of nature, he says, from famine and death, the most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of the higher animals, directly follows. There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms most beautiful and most wonderful have been and are being evolved. He concludes his book with that kind of poetic statement about evolution, but you can pick out the key features of his theory, particularly the notion of natural selection. When variations occur within a population of a given species, struggling to survive on limited resources, the organisms that enjoy variations that give them a kind of advantage over the others in that environment tend to be the ones that survive and breed and pass the variation down to the next generation. Again, as Darwin explains, It may be said that natural selection is daily and hourly scrutinizing throughout the world every variation, even the slightest, rejecting that which is bad, preserving and adding up all that is good, silently and insensibly working, whenever and wherever opportunity offers, at the improvement of each organic being in relation to its organic and inorganic conditions of life. We see nothing in these slow changes of progress until the hand of time has marked the long lapses of ages, and then so imperfect is our view into the long past geological ages that we see only that the forms of life are now different from what they formerly were. We could sum up his idea of evolution by calling it descent with modification from a common ancestor by means of natural selection. Now, while Darwin exploited the idea of natural selection, he didn't have himself a mechanism to explain how variations arose or how they were preserved, how they were handed down from one generation to the next. It was the work of the Augustinian monk, biologist Gregor Mendel, so no conflict between religion and sciences, Augustinian monk here at the beginning of these studies, Gregor Mendel. His ideas were later used to answer some of these questions. Studying how traits are preserved among generations, he was using pea plants. Mendel postulated that biological inheritance was accomplished through particulate factors that are inherited from one from each parent, which don't mix or blend, but segregate in the formation of sex cells or gametes. A genetic variation would give rise to new physical traits, which, if the organism survived and reproduced, would then be genetically handed down to the next generation. Mendel produced his work in 1868, but its importance wasn't recognized until the early 20th century. In 1953, the work of James Watson and Francis Crick revealed the structure of deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA, as the molecular carrier of genetic traits. So when the science of genetics was added to Darwin's theory, there was a more complete understanding of evolution. The theory could now account for spontaneous variations in new generations of offspring through spontaneous genetic change, as well as the stable passing on of characteristics through genetic inheritance. Note that this account of evolution says nothing about God's influence one way or the other. Rightly enough, it doesn't even mention God, since the question of divine influence lies beyond the method of science. But early in its history, evolutionary science collected a lot of accretions that had themselves quite a bit to say about God. So now we're down to accretions in the science of evolution. We should know first that while Darwin did not include God as part of his theory, he didn't exclude God's influence. At one point, he remarks, "Authors of highest eminence seem to be fully satisfied with the view that each species has been independently created. To my mind, it accords better with what we know of the laws impressed on matter by the Creator that the production and extinction of the past and present inhabitants of the world should have been due to secondary causes like those determining the birth and death of the individual." So individuals are born and die without a kind of special divine intervention. It seems that whole species might also come into being and cease to be also through natural causes. So we'll have more to say about secondary causality in a moment. From the moment Darwin first published on the origin of species, though, various thinkers began exploiting aspects of his theories for their own ends. So the philosopher Herbert Spencer applied the theory to human society, finding there also an inherent competition that led to the survival of the more fit of the human species. In fact, he's the one that coined the phrase survival of the fittest. His social Darwinism was antithetical to Christian notions of social justice and the common good. seeing ruthless competition as the only way to ensure the advance of the human race. Biologist Thomas Huxley, 1825 to 1895, drew the theological conclusion that Darwin's work eliminated the need for and practically excluded the possibility of divine intervention in the origin of species, especially the human species. Today, the biologist Richard Dawkins makes similar claims about the atheistic implications of evolutionary theory in his book, The God Delusion. Such accretions certainly make the theory of evolution look antithetical to the dignity of the human person and to God's providential action in the world. They make it understandable why some Christians have thought it necessary to reject the theory of evolution itself. They also illustrate the propensity of some biologists to draw philosophical or theological conclusions from the theory, which are not justified by the empirical science of evolution. So it would be important for us to sort out the science of evolution from these other claims that are said to be based on it. So we can look at reactions to evolution. In their book, The Evolution from Creation to New Creation, Ted Peters and Marty Hewlett point out how difficult it is to separate the science of evolution from ideological accretions that have grown up around it. They suggest that evolutionary theory now comes somehow shrink-wrapped in claims and attitudes that are extrinsic to evolutionary science. Reactions against evolution are often really aimed at accretions that lie beyond the theory as such, but it's hard to sort out what claims are proper to the science and what are extrinsic or even ideological presuppositions. Since science and ideology are hard to separate in this case, some Christians have thought it best to reject the science of evolution altogether. They suggest other ways of explaining the origin of species, especially of human beings. One alternative goes by the name of creationism. Here we can distinguish old earth creationists from young earth creationists. The old earth creationists allow for a 13.7 billion year old universe and a 4.5 billion year old earth. They hold that God originally created many species and allow that with the help of divine intervention, these species have evolved through mutation and natural selection. But then there are the young earth creationists who argue, by pointing to the absence of transitional forms in the fossil record, that the theory of evolution is unable to explain the development of all living things from one initial type. They support a literal reading of the six-day creation account of Genesis and argue that the earth is less than 10,000 years old. From its American beginnings, the movement has spread to over 30 countries, and it runs the Institute for Creation Research near San Diego. Now, creationism had its day in court in 1925 in Dayton, Tennessee, when a high school teacher, John Scopes, was charged with illegally teaching the theory of evolution. With William Jennings Bryan as prosecutor, Clarence Darrow as defender, the court rendered a verdict of guilty, which was then later overturned on a technical point by the Tennessee Supreme Court. And it dismissed the case altogether, commenting that nothing is to be gained by prolonging the life of this bizarre case. So a wise decision by the justices. The U.S. Supreme Court intervened 43 years later in 1968 in Epperson versus Arkansas to decide that laws prohibiting the teaching of evolution were unconstitutional since they violated the Establishment of Religion Clause, the First Amendment. An alternative to creationism is intelligent design, or ID. ID doesn't deny natural selection or descent from a common ancestor. It simply argues that certain organisms or organic structures exhibit a degree of complexity that requires the influence of an intelligent designer. So the biologist Michael Behe, for instance, describes the bacterial flagellum as irreducibly complex. It can't be reduced to something simple. He uses the analogy of a mousetrap, as a mousetrap won't work for you if you remove any one of its parts, the spring, catch, bar, etc. So the bacterial flagellum won't work if you remove any one of its parts, and it has a lot of them. The flagellum comprises roughly 30 different proteins, all precisely arranged. If any one of them is removed, the flagellum stops spinning. A working flagellum spinning at more than 20,000 RPMs, it propels the bacterium through its aquatic world. How could such a structure be built piece by piece by chance, as evolution involving only genetic mutation combined with natural selection suggests? ID doesn't name the designer, but suggests it could be a transcendent god or intelligent being from another place. Michael Behe suggests aliens from Alpha Centauri. All you need is some sort of a designer. ID simply argues that in the same way a crime scene might imply that the death of the victim was not by chance, but the result of some plan, so the evidence of nature suggests the influence of intelligent design. ID has been championed by the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute in Seattle. Now, the Dominican Cardinal Christoph Schönborn, who was one of my professors in Freiburg in Switzerland in the early 1980s, who was also the chief editor of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, he weighed into this discussion with an op-ed piece in the New York Times in 2005. My dear old professor, overlooking the usual love for distinctions that you find among the followers of Thomas Aquinas, painted the situation in broad strokes, seeing neo-Darwinism as involving a denial of design and so also of divine providence. Since then, though, he's distanced himself from ID. He wrote a book, Chance or Purpose, in 2007. And in it, ID is rarely mentioned. And when it is mentioned, it's mentioned critically. He wisely notes that an essential condition for combining belief in the creator with the theory of evolution is that the limits of scientific theory be respected. So we'll have more to say also in a moment on the limits of science. Meantime, we should note that the Cardinal's editorial provoked a good deal of debate, which resulted in some helpful distinctions. Especially useful are some remarks of Nicola Cabivo, the president of the Pontifical Academy of Science, a panel that advises the Pope on scientific matters. So you can find the quotation from him on the handout as well. I'll just read the last sentence. To Darwin's theory, there are two different possible reactions. One is the atheistic view, saying that since we know how it works, we don't need God. This goes beyond the scientific facts because it is a metaphysical conclusion. The other is the theistic response, believing that God is the cause of this process of evolution. Well, we'll have to say some more about how God might be involved in the process of evolution. Meantime, we should note that ID also got its day in court in the case of Kitzmiller versus the Dover Area School District in Pennsylvania. The judge decided in 2005 that the mandated teaching of ID was unconstitutional, also because of the Establishment Clause. The judge also concluded that ID is simply not science because it depends on supernatural intervention, which cannot be explained by natural causes or be proven through empirical investigation, and therefore is neither testable nor falsifiable. Down to scientific method now. Before we take the court's word for what is or is not science, we might take a closer look at the issue ourselves. Since the time of Galileo, empirical science has followed a well-defined and quite successful path of inquiry known as the hypothetical deductive method. It begins with observation, collection of data that can be represented quantitatively. This is ideally an objective exercise, but it inevitably involves subjective factors in what data you look at and how you interpret it. It's sometimes said that the data is theory laden, since you tend to see the world in terms of the particular scientific theory that you're using. But at the same time, as a corrective, you have to say that the theory itself is data laden, since it's founded upon certain observations or data. Well, after observing, you invent a hypothesis to make sense out of the data. You then deduce or predict certain conclusions or outcomes from the hypothesis, set up experiments to verify or falsify your predictions. And if the experiment is a failure, you can either decide that the hypothesis was incorrect, invent a new one, or go back and check the experiment again, try it out. Where did it go wrong? If the experiment is successful, you have a working theory to use in further investigations. This, of course, doesn't mean that the hypothesis actually nails down the real reasons why the predicted result occurred. It indicates only that you now have an adequate model for predicting results, which you can use until something better comes along. For instance, if you have tons of observations, astronomical observations about positions of the planets and so on, you might look for a model or hypothesis of planetary motion that could account for all of the data. In fact, over the centuries, numerous models have emerged. To determine whether a given model or hypothesis is valid or useful, you can make deductions or predictions based on the hypothesis. You might say, for instance, that if the planet moves in a certain hypothetical pattern, then Mars should be in this position of the sky on this date, and then verify the deduction. Of course, you can't really experiment on planetary motion. You can't take the planets into your lab and see how they work. But you could kind of wait around patiently for the predicted date to arrive and see if the planet is where you said it was going to be. Or more easily, you can kind of use your model to go back historically, check data of the past, and see if based on your model, the positions of the planet in the past line up with where you would expect it to be. Astronomers have engaged in this kind of activity for centuries, long before the time of Galileo. The medievals thought of it as inventing a hypothesis to save the appearances or to fit the observed data. A number of models have come and gone. The Earth-centered model of Ptolemy, very exciting because Ptolemy, of course, said, as everyone knows, that the Earth is here at the center of the universe and all of the other heavenly bodies revolve around it. But just with normal circles, the planets tend to wander through the heavens, so they don't fit the pattern. So take the planet and put it on a circle, going around a circle. And if that doesn't do the trick for you, you can put another circle in. You put the planet on that circle, going around this circle, going around that circle, going around that circle, going around the Earth. And actually, it's pretty effective. If you Google eccentrics and epicycles. This is an eccentric little circle, epicycle large. You come up with a website where, using just eccentrics and epicycles, they give you a portrait of Bart Simpson. But the little dot goes round and round, and the other dot, and round and round and round, and eventually, so it comes out. So it's very flexible in terms of describing motions, but according to a particular way. It's very regular. It's all circular, but it can account for a lot of unusual motions. Well, this was the theory of Ptolemy, and quite effective, quite fine. It worked well. But then Copernicus came along, Galileo, Newton, and Kepler. with a sun-centered universe, and then Einstein with relativity theory. Each of these models was verified, and so it became an accepted theory, but a theory that could always be replaced when a better one came along. Now, Thomas Aquinas himself was aware of the tenuous nature of the conclusions of such science. It's also in the handout. He wrote, "In astronomy, the theory of eccentrics and epicycles is considered as established because thereby the sensible appearances of the heavenly movements can be explained. Not, however, as if this proof were sufficient, for as much as some other theory might explain them." So quite amazing in the Middle Ages, thinking that there could be a better theory to explain the motion of the heavens than the one then currently popular. So open to developments in science. So we might ask, is evolutionary theory a verified theory, or is it still a working hypothesis? If natural selection by definition is a process that takes place over millennia, we can't expect it to be verified or falsified in a single experiment, as was possible with Einstein's theory of relativity. So regarding this question, Francisco Ayala, a biologist at UC Irvine, makes a distinction between first the fact of evolution, then evolutionary theory, history, and thirdly the mechanisms or processes of evolution. He thinks that the fact of evolution is the most fundamental issue and thinks that this is established with utmost certainty. And he sees evidence for evolution in the fossil records of paleontology, comparative anatomy, embryology, biochemistry, and finally, evidence from molecular biology has shown all living organisms, from bacteria to humans, to be related by descent from a common ancestor. So the fact of evolution seems well established. Evolutionary history, when what happened, less well established. However, many issues regarding when and how evolution occurred, he said, remain largely unresolved. So the theory postulates certain things, but hasn't yet resolved how they happen. So is the theory of evolution established? What does it mean to establish a theory? Albert Einstein argued that the truth of a scientific theory doesn't lie simply in its experimental confirmation, but in whether it is able to account for many observations in a unified way. He says the theory, any scientific theory, finds the justification for its existence in the fact that it correlates a large number of single observations, and it is just here that the truth of the theory lies. Well, this idea of truth seems rather utilitarian. If it works, it's true. Ted Peters and Martinez Hewlett don't claim that Darwin's theory is true, but they do claim that it is a good theory. So instead of saying true, you might say good. If you're a metaphysician, you know the good and the true are interchangeable. But you can use the word good theory. Good for good reasons. Why? Evolution provides a unified explanation of empirical observations. It's fertile in that it can make predictions which open avenues to further scientific research. And thirdly, it's falsifiable. It's subject to revision or replacement if you get a better model. They argue that creationism and ID, intelligent design, tend to close off rather than open new lines of research. If the amazing similarity between species is explained, as in creationism, simply by the fact that God created things that way, then further inquiry in that direction is at an end. Or if, as intelligent design argues, certain organs or organisms exhibit an irreducible complexity that simply cannot be explained in terms of undirected natural causes, then the search for such natural explanations also is at an end. Or is it? Perhaps what's really happening is that creation and ID are pursuing a kind of inquiry beyond the bounds of science. This raises the question of what kinds of inquiry these two disciplines are. So creationism, if it is taking its starting point from divine revelation, say, from the book of Genesis, then perhaps it should be understood as a mode of faith seeking understanding, the mode of inquiry that we call theology. So perhaps creationism is really theology. As such, it wouldn't close off inquiry, but open human understanding to the infinite truth of revelation. The certitude of the fundamental truths of creationism then, if that were the case, would not be the provisional or tentative certitude of science, where one theory may eventually replace another. It would have the very certitude of revelation. Based on the revelation of God's creative act, one could then use all of the resources of human reason, including empirical science, to penetrate the depth of that revelation. So if creationism is really theology, then the question is not whether creationism is good science, but whether it's good theology. That might be a challenging question for creationists, since the literalistic interpretation of Scripture on which they base their arguments may itself turn out to be bad theology, lacking the interpretation and the nuance that's required for a true understanding of the inspired text. With intelligent design, it may also be pointing to some area of inquiry that lies beyond the bounds of empirical science, and its insistence that events in the natural world point to the influence of an intelligent designer. It surely begins with empirical science, but its faithful pursuit of that inquiry leads it to affirm the influence of an agency that lies beyond scientific method, the designer. We might say it steps out of the boundaries of science and into the realm of philosophy. It's still a reasoned inquiry into the natural world, but one that's not confined to the limits of scientific method. So if ID, intelligent design, is really philosophy, then the question to ask is not whether ID is good science, but whether it's good philosophy. That might raise some challenging issues for ID, such as whether it has validly established its premise of irreducible complexity, whether that premise provides sufficient grounds for postulating some sort of transcendent designer, and even whether the designer that it has in mind is sufficiently transcendent to be called God. It's interesting that in his autobiography, Darwin himself raises the question of whether design in nature points to the existence of God. Darwin says, "Another source of conviction in the existence of God impresses me as having much more weight. This follows from the extreme difficulty, or rather impossibility, of conceiving this immense and wonderful universe, including man with his capacity for looking far backwards and far into futurity, as the result of blind chance or necessity. When thus reflecting, I feel compelled to look at the first cause having an intelligent mind in some degree analogous to that of man, and I deserve to be called a theist." Charles Darwin. Later years, however, Charles Darwin was less convinced. He later writes, "In my most extreme fluctuations, I have never been an atheist in the sense of denying the existence of God. I think that generally, and the more and more as I grow older, but not always, that an agnostic would be the more correct description for my state of mind." So Darwin himself entertaining these ideas of design. Thomas Aquinas also thinks that the presence of design in nature might have implications for the existence of God. He uses it as the premise of his fifth way of showing the existence of God. So Thomas Aquinas has his famous five ways at the beginning of his Summa Theological, five ways of showing that God exists. This is the fifth. Aquinas doesn't begin with the overall pattern of nature or with the complexity of a certain biological structure. Instead, he starts with what we might call the empirical observation that things without intelligence act intelligently, insofar as they act for an end. He's thinking of things like spiders building webs to catch insects. Since such things achieve their end regularly, he reasons that they must do this not by chance, but by design. Since whatever lacks intelligence, though, cannot move towards an end unless directed by some being endowed with knowledge and intelligence, he gives the example of how an arrow that's shot towards a target by an archer doesn't reach the target without the influence of the archer. So some intelligent being must exist by whom all natural things are directed to their end, and this being we call God. But unlike ID, which postulates, you might say, a kind of deistic designer tinkering with the universe long, long ago in the past, designing a bacterial flagellum or something else of irreducible complexity, Aquinas affirms the present influence of the Creator in the actions of creatures that are happening right now before our eyes, but an action of the Creator in ways that lie beyond the reach of scientific method. So even as one is watching the spider with no degree in engineering building the web, and you can see it happens all the time, over and over and over again, and it achieves something. The thing without intelligence acting for a purpose must here and now be somehow directed by a intelligence. And how Aquinas explains that allows for God's immanence here and now within the created world. Not a God who did something eons ago, but in this moment, the influence of the Creator must be present. But then how do we speak about God's action in the world? How can we understand that action in ways that don't negate but ground the investigations of empirical science? Aquinas looks at such issues in his question 105 of his Summa, where he asks whether God works in every agent. To him, the presence of divine agency doesn't mean that our investigation of natural agents is at an end. Their causal activities retain their own integrity and can be studied in themselves. This is the work of natural science. But beyond natural science, we can also ask how the activities of those natural agents point beyond themselves to a divine agency. We ponder how to understand the influence of that agency in relation to the causality of natural agents. Okay. All of this indicates the limits of scientific method and these exciting areas of inquiry, whether theology or philosophy, that lie beyond the limits of empirical science. Now, empirical scientist Francisco Ayala has an example of the limits of science. He uses Picasso's painting of Guernica, if you're familiar with that. It was depicting the German bombardment of a Basque village. And Ayala says, well, science could explain a lot about that, the size of the picture, configuration of the figures, pigment of the ink, type of canvas, etc. But all of that would miss the point, huh? The point being the aesthetic, the moral import of the painting. So Ayala concludes that once science has had its say, there remains much about reality that is of interest, questions of value and meaning that are forever beyond science's scope. Science views the world empirically, describes it quantitatively, and so it can't, without violating its own method, comment on realms of being that lie beyond that method. It's only when science is turned into what we sometimes call scientism. Scientism. This kind of ideology claiming science as its base. It's only then that such comments arise. Scientism turns the method of science, the valid method of science, with its limited quantitative approach to the world, into a metaphysics by the scientifically unjustifiable claim that there is nothing that science cannot investigate, that reality itself is limited to the scope of scientific method, that what cannot be quantified simply is not real. And of course, such conclusions are not things that come out of science as such. You see, scientism in the area of evolution, with evolutionism, especially in the claims of some biologists that evolution eliminates the need for God. Okay, down to the point on the Catholic Church and evolution. So, to consider the relation between Christianity and evolution, we take Roman Catholicism as a kind of test case and the statements of different popes. So Pius XII sorted out science from scientism in his encyclical Humani Generis, 1950, criticizing those who would conflate the theory of evolution with an ideology of monism or pantheism. He notes that in his view, the theory of evolution, he says, has not been fully proved, even in the domain of natural science. So is it a theory, or is it something more than a theory? He explained that the Church doesn't forbid research regarding the doctrine of evolution, insofar as it inquires into the origins of the human body as coming from pre-existent living matter. At the same time, he says, Catholic faith obliges us to hold that souls are immediately created by God. Okay. In such research, he says, arguments favorable and unfavorable to evolution should be weighed and judged with the necessary seriousness, moderation, and measures, open to evolutionary science, preserving certain church doctrinal understandings. But those understandings themselves, when is the soul created? What is the nature of the soul? Lie beyond the reach of empirical investigation. On the handout, you see a couple of quotes from Pope John Paul II, now St. John Paul II. He was a lot more welcoming, a lot less wary than Pius XII about evolution. He notes that Pius XII had called the theory of evolution an unproved hypothesis, and he remarks, today, almost half a century after the publication of the encyclical Humani Generis, a new knowledge has led us to realize the theory of evolution is no longer a mere hypothesis. There was a lot of discussion about what he meant by that. No longer a mere hypothesis. Is it a fact or what is it? The Pope, however, echoes Pius XII's teaching that if the human body takes its origin from pre-existent living matter, the spiritual soul is and must be immediately created by God. John Paul did his own sorting out, reconciling of the methods of science, philosophy, and theology, which you find on the handout there. He says, consideration of the method used in the various branches of knowledge makes it possible to reconcile two points which seem irreconcilable. Begin with empirical science. The sciences of observation describe and measure the multiple manifestations of life with increasing precision and correlate them with a timeline. The moment of transition to the spiritual cannot be the object of this kind of observation, which, nevertheless, can discover at the experimental level a series of very valuable signs indicating what is specific to the human being. Empirical science, then philosophy. But the experience of metaphysical knowledge, of self-awareness, self-reflection, moral conscience, freedom, or again of aesthetic and religious experience, falls within the competence of philosophical analysis and reflection, while, thirdly, theology brings out its ultimate meaning according to the Creator's plan. Pope Benedict XVI also discussed evolution in his book, Schöpfung und Evolution, or Creation and Evolution, 2007. He points out that evolution raises philosophical questions that science can't answer. He says, I find it important to underline that the theory of evolution implies questions that must be assigned to philosophy, which themselves lead beyond the realm of science. He sees consequences to not observing the limits of science. Eventually, even the Christian idea of God can be regarded as unscientific if science is said to include everything within its ambit. He also is a little more skeptical about evolution. He thinks that microevolution within a species, a certain evolutionary trend. The color of the moth changes from dark to light because of environmental factors and so on. No trouble with that. But macroevolution, he doesn't think, has been established. Okay, then Pope Francis in 2014 got into the act as well with a talk he gave to the Pontifical Academy of the Sciences. He says, when we read the account of creation in Genesis, we risk imagining that God was a magician, complete with an all-powerful magic wand. But that it was not so. He created beings and he let them develop according to the internal laws with which he endowed each one, that they might develop and reach their fullness. He gave autonomy to the beings of the universe at the same time in which he assured them of his continual presence, giving life to every reality. And thus creation has been progressing for centuries and centuries, millennia and millennia, until becoming as we know it today, precisely because God is not a demiurge or magician, but the creator who gives life to all things. The beginnings of the world was not the work of chaos, owing its origin to something else, but derives directly from the supreme principle who creates out of love. Evolution in nature does not conflict with the notion of creation because evolution presupposes the creation of beings who evolve. Okay, how to put this together with secondary causality. So we're down to the very bottom of that page. We'll have to flip over in a second. Evolution and secondary causality. How does evolution fit together with God's causality? I think a lot are adverse or skeptical about allowing for any divine influence in evolution, since they think that divine influence would outlaw or overrule all other natural causes. But I don't think that's the case. If it were, then we'd have to make a choice, God or evolution, not both. But I think instead we can invoke that Catholic principle of both and rather than either or. Not either God or evolution, but both God and evolution. They can fit together. Okay, we sort out the different orders of causality. I'm not sure how the picture emerges, how evolution itself may be an instrument of God's providential action in the world. And I'll do that by using, guess who again, Thomas Aquinas, in his commentary on Aristotle's work on interpretation. It is a bit dense. The rest of this talk, you know, it's been quite light. Nothing complex about it at all, but this gets a little bit dense, I have to admit here. So we'll try to run through this briefly. In the middle of the page there, that paragraph. There's likewise a difference to be noted on the part of the divine will, for the divine will must be understood as existing outside the order of beings, as a cause producing the whole of being and all of its differences. So God isn't found in among, as if God were just one more being among many, but the creator of all. Now, the possible and the necessary are differences of being, different modes of being. Therefore, necessity and contingency in things, and the distinction of each according to the nature of proximate causes, originate from the divine will. He disposes necessary causes for effects that he wills to be necessary, ordains causes acting contingently for effects that will be contingent. The order, the condition of these causes, according to the condition of the causes, effects are called either necessary or contingent, although all depend on the divine will as the first cause, which transcends that order. This, however, cannot be said for the human will or any other cause, for every other cause already falls under the order of necessity or contingency. Hence, either the cause itself must be able to fail, or if not, it is not contingent but necessary. The divine will, on the other hand, is unfailing, yet not all of its effects are necessary. Some are contingent. How does that work? Well, basically, you have the relationship of cause and effect. A cause produces an effect. Then you can ask, well, what about that effect? Is it contingent or is it necessary? A contingent effect can, it may or may not happen. A necessary effect has to happen. It cannot not happen. But given some effect, is it necessary or is it contingent? Can you tell by looking at the effect itself? So you look at the, here we are ourselves, or you yourselves, sitting around here this evening. We've been here for some time already. And you'd say, is that a contingent action on your part or necessary? Could you be doing something else? Lots of things. Or is it necessary? You could not be doing this. Well, it depends on how you look at it, huh? Certainly, your decision to be here was your own free decision, and therefore, contingent decision. But given that right now, here you are sitting here, you cannot simultaneously not be sitting here. So there is a certain certain necessity to your action as well. Okay? So if you look only at the effect, you can't really tell whether it's contingent or necessary, because in the moment of its happening, every effect has a certain kind of necessity. It cannot not be happening as it is in fact happening. So to decide contingent or necessary, you have to look at the relationship between cause and effect, and then you'll find that some causes are necessary and others are contingent. Some causes cannot not produce their effect. Hard to find them in our conception of the world where everything is so contingent, but maybe gravity, if you take it as a necessary cause of things falling down. I let go and wham, it falls down. It cannot not fall. So a necessary cause. On the other hand, contingent. If I throw the chalk at the fire alarm, will it hit it or not? Depends on luck, how good the shot is. So it's contingent effect, coming from a contingent cause. Okay, so if you look again at causes and effects at the bottom of the handout, you can classify them as necessary causes in the natural world, like gravity, or contingent causes, like an archer with the arrow. Is it going to hit the target or not? Might not. And within contingent causes, free will is there. Freedom to do one thing or another is contingent. And even the causality we call chance. You happen to meet someone on the mall. You weren't planning to, but there they are. Chance occurrences are also contingent. So if you try, as in the middle of the page, to line up, and this was a lineup of all natural causes that you find in the natural world, some are necessary, infallible causes, column one, producing necessary effects. Some are contingent causes, defectible, causing contingent effects. Some are free, producing free effects. And then there's this chance, producing chance effects. Then, where does God belong in this? Is God necessary cause, contingent cause, free cause, or simply chance? Where would you put him? In which column? If you're familiar with multiple choice tests or multiple guess tests, often the last option is none of the above. So this is one of those none of the above. God doesn't belong to any of those categories of created causes. God is, as the diagram shows, a transcendent cause. God is above contingency and necessity, ordaining necessary causes for necessary effects, contingent causes for contingent effects, but God himself beyond the necessity and contingency. But notice that none of these created causes, necessity, contingency, freedom, chance, produces their effect at all without the influence of God as the source of all actuality. So each one of them produces some actual effect, but the created cause can't do that without the influence of the being who is the cause of all actuality, so this transcendent being. But God's causality doesn't bump these natural causes out of the way. Rather, within necessary causes, God acts so that they do produce necessary effects. And contingent causes. The eternal God acts in the contingencies of nature so that they produce contingent effects that may or may not be. And the same with freedom. It's a great dilemma in theology. How can the all-powerful, omnipotent, etc., God act in us without destroying our human freedom? But God is the transcendent cause who not only causes something to be, but causes the mode of its being. So God acts within the intimacy of our human freedom to allow us to produce free human acts. In case you're worried, there is a tiny little fudge clause up in the top paragraph here on the handout. God is the source of all actuality, is involved in every causal instantiation of actual being. And exercising his causal influence, God wills not only that a thing, only the things that are actualized, but also the way in which they're actualized. Parentheses, God is not involved in sin as such, since the evil of sin does not consist in actuality, but in privation, lack of actuality. So this is St. Augustine. Evil is a lack of something. Okay, so how does this work out with evolution? Evolution presupposes in some ways necessary cause, natural selection. That organism that is best suited to its environment will, by natural selection, be selected for survival, a kind of necessity. But God acts through necessary causes. Chance is also there as a feature of evolution. New features arise by genetic changes that happen by chance, but God is also involved in the phenomenon of chance and chance effects. So God's causal influence as a transcendent cause is not excluded from contingency. Rather, contingent causes couldn't exercise their causality without God's influence. So putting this all together, different kinds of causality, we can see that God's influence in necessity and chance is involved in evolution and doesn't rob the natural causes of their proper character of contingency or necessity. So it's not a question of God or chance. Rather, chance itself is part of God's plan. Chance itself plays a role in God's providential causality that transcends both chance and necessity. We can also say that without God's influence as the source of all actuality, there couldn't be any creaturely causality, whether necessary or contingent. And so there couldn't be any phenomenon of evolution at all. Evolution doesn't exclude God's influence. Rather, evolution could not happen without God's influence. So we factored together the different approaches to reality that we've been looking at, approaches of empirical science, philosophy, theology. We can see that these don't contradict or exclude one another, but complement one another, leading to a more complete account of the world of our own faith and experience. And that leads us to a very brief conclusion. Does the theory of evolution disprove Christianity? Nope. Thank you. Yes.
So I think I have a question on the mind of God. Mm-hmm. So I think if suppose that I was God and had to create the whole thing, mm-hmm. and suppose that I wanted it to look random, mm-hmm. and unplanned.
Right.
I wanted it to look as if there were no divinity involved. Mm-hmm. I wanted people not to believe in me. Mm-hmm. So which method would I use? I mean, how would I make the world look? I think I would make it exactly like it is now. I mean, I would choose it to be evolution by natural selection. Mm-hmm. So what I'm getting at is that, so given that Homo sapiens is like 200,000 years old, if you think of all the suffering of all the preceding generations that has gone into giving rise to us, it's an extremely wasteful, mm-hmm. process. It's an extremely brutal process. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, life has been extremely brutal for most of the time, right? Mm-hmm. So has it ever occurred to you that God is sort of, I mean, if the Christian God exists, he's sort of playing a very big hide and seek in terms of the creation.
Playing a
hide and seek.
Oh, hide and seek.
Making it look exactly as if there is no divinity.
Yeah, so in that case you'd have something like Descartes' evil demon or something, and not the goodness.
Maybe, yeah.
So just a god who plays with the world and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would probably say that no evolutionary theory does not disprove Christianity logically. Mm-hmm. But I would say, I think that it's a nail in the coffin.
Evolution's a nail in the coffin?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an indication that God does not exist. Uh-huh. But I wouldn't say it follows logically, it's just one mm-hmm. of many.
Yes, I mean, this is the thing, the goodness of God as creator, okay? So God wants to share his goodness with another. If it's sheer love that's the basis of creation, simply for the sake of sharing his own goodness, he does that. But in what way? Well, one thing it seems that God can't do is create another God. It's almost a contradiction in terms. So it'd be like creating a square circle or something. Not that God can't do it, it's something that just simply doesn't make sense. It's not doable. Okay. So whatever God creates is going to be a creature, less than God. And then what kind of creatures? Well, the book of Genesis says that God created all things and saw that they were good, or saw that they were very good. Note that doesn't use the word perfect, and certainly not infallible. So somehow, in divine love, even the creature that's capable of failure is a good creature. And God shares his own creativity, in a sense, with the creature. Another way God could have operated is just to do everything in nature himself. And we would go around like automatons moving our hands, but not accomplishing everything. God would do everything, plus in occasions. God shared his creativity, his causality with us, and we're contingent creatures. So that means we live in a contingent world, which is also a good world. And evolution is part of that contingency. You can look at evolution, I suppose, from either end of a telescope and say it's created lots of suffering in the world. But even Darwin looking at evolution and kind of amazed at all it has, the summit of created being that's produced by this process. So is God hiding? Well, I don't think so. If hiding, then hiding in plain sight. Because the scripture says, theologically, the heavens proclaim the glory of God. Creation reflects the glory and the goodness of God. Each being, each contingent, limited being, somehow points back to the reality of its source, of the creator. So creation is like a mirror reflecting God if one looks at it and where it's pointing to, okay? So I think that in a sense, God isn't hiding. It's just that if we look, you see, Paul says in this letter to the Romans, you know, the things of God are manifest in the things that have been created. So, cause and effect. The cause is God, the effect is the creature. The creature points back to God. This is Aquinas' five ways of showing the existence of God, beginning with creatures and seeing how they point out their own inadequacy. They don't explain themselves, they point back to the creator. Even the goodness of the creature points back to the goodness of the creator. But, of course, there is the problem of evil, which I haven't mentioned yet, but it's quite important, huh? So how do we deal with that? Well, I suppose you can deal with it metaphysically, as St. Augustine does, and say that evil itself isn't a a reality opposed to goodness, but it's simply a lack, a failure in goodness. It's a privation of goodness. So in terms of its ontological character, goodness has being, evil has simply lack of being. But you can't have a lack of being all by itself. The evil, the lack of being, has to be in something. If you have a rotten apple that's a bad apple, it has to first have an apple. It has to have first being before there can be lack of being. So Aquinas says even the evil in the world being simply a lack, you know, the sphere and then something is missing. The fact that something is missing shows you that there's something there, and the being of things points back to God. Well, then how come something is missing? Why would God allow that? Well, he allows creatures to be contingent. Some simply able to fail, like the flowers of the field that blossom today and tomorrow die. But that's still a good thing. They're good creatures. The fact that they don't last forever doesn't make them bad. Contingency is good in the created world. But evil, why allow evil, especially the evil of sin, or the horrendous evils that you see in the world? Well, Aquinas says God would not permit evil unless God were powerful enough to bring good even out of evil. It's a faith statement. It's analogous to the way that God could bring being out of non-being in creating the world. God powerful enough to create, bring being out of non-being. Well, if this is the good and the lack of good, that's a simple non-being in a sense, lack of goodness, God can bring good even out of evil. And the paradigm for the Christian community of how that happens is the evil of the cross, the suffering of the just man on the cross. How could that be redemptive? It seems horrendous, it's total injustice, and so on and so forth. And yet, the power of God is such as to bring the good of redemption, eternal life, out of the death of Christ on the cross. How that happens, I don't know. But that's a kind of faith statement as a response. So is God hiding? I don't think so. Playing the puppeteer, you know, just toying along with creation? I don't think so. I think the fact of creation itself is an indication of divine goodness. And no doubt, reality, failure of creatures, especially moral failure, is a reality in the world. We don't deny that. We have to, though, describe the character of that reality as a lack of being, and then believe that God can bring good even out of evil. Sometimes we see it, you know. You get sick, you have to spend a day in bed, you know, cause you to relax, rethink, do that. You see, draw a moral. No, something good happened because of that inconvenience. But that's trivial, you know. But if trivial evils can produce some sort of good, then even horrendous evil, you know. So, but that happens beyond what we see, you know. So eventually, in a life to come, we don't see that in this life. But I mean, that's my response.
How do you reconcile, like, scripture saying God made man in his own image, uh-huh. and, like, the evolutionary fact that it's taken, like, hominids 20,000 years to get into this, like, physical shape and form?
Right.
And so which image is God creating?
Yes, or how does God do that?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I think part of the goodness of God in creation, making the creatures, is allowing them to share as causes themselves in God's own causality, and they can have effects. So God doesn't do an end run and make every effect all by himself, and creatures are just there as showpieces. They don't really do anything. No, I think part of the goodness of God is to share his own creativity, his with the creature, with creaturely causes, then what? Through that interaction of creatures. And when we would say, maybe from the Big Bang on, first there's a kind of an evolution of the universe, in some ways by chance, in some ways by necessity in the interaction of things, okay? Comes about a solar system like ours, where there's a planet capable of life. Does God create the first life, perhaps? Does life itself simply evolve from molecular realities? In either case, nothing happens within the created realm without the influence of the divine. So, the complexity of that creaturely interaction, God is ultimately the source, and eventually through these effects you have, say, a human being in the image of God. Well, how in the image of God? Certainly not in origins. Even in the biblical story, humans are made from the dirt of the earth. Well, that's not like God. So it's not everything about us. But what is it that's human? And it's certainly the human person, the human reality is like God. I think fundamentally in the ability that we have to know and to love. If God is love, then humans capable of love are image of God. So in that way, but humans are able to know and love because we act through our physical nature. I couldn't know anything if I didn't first have sensation of things. That's a physical process. No? We have sense knowledge and we react with appetites of sense. But we also have an intellect and a will and can react on that spiritual level as well. So in those ways, we are the image of God. We are made in the image and likeness of God. But whether we're made in a moment, fiat, God says, think, and there we are, or whether we come into being over eons of evolution, still, as we are now, we are the image and likeness of God. And if we do come about through these ages of evolutionary process, it's because God allows God's own will and purposes to be accomplished through creatures, even contingent creatures, even chance occurrences. All of that fits under the great umbrella of divine providence.
But wouldn't that providence be in some sense wasteful, given that, like, more than 99% of creatures that ever existed are now extinct? And that, and in this case, you're kind of going towards the statement that you made that you don't want God to be like someone who just made something in the past and let that happen through as time takes its course, but rather someone who is like continuously giving input into like the human condition.
So I believe that God is continually, constantly giving input, giving influence, causality into the human condition here. There's influences there all the time. It's not like God way back when did something and walked away and creation rolls along. No. All the time, constantly, God is acting in the world. But then we're economists, we're accountants, we have balance sheets, and we say, pluses and minuses. Whoa, my gosh, the minus column here is quite large compared to the plus over here. And we give an economical evaluation of that. Well, maybe it's not an economical question, you know. There's more joy in heaven over one sinner that repents than over 99 who have no need of repentance. 99 good people, one sinner. How does that balance out? Well, it's not that kind of reality. So we can look at it that way and say, what a waste. Or we can look at the series of causes, each one doing its thing, each one acting according to its particular nature, and achieving something, little spider building its web, whatever it is, things could be much more efficient. But God creates a contingent world, a world where sometimes things aren't efficient, but inefficiency doesn't mean not good either. The contingent, the inefficient, the bumbling can still be good, which is kind of a comfort when we're on our off days. Yes.
This is a silly question. I might be able to ask better ones, but this is the one you're getting.
All right.
How how 150 years before the internet did both Christians and non-Christians get Darwin so wrong so fast?
That's a very good question.
Is it just sin? You know, in the sense that the genders,
mm-hmm.
finitude, more finitude?
Yeah.
Is it just how we're wired? But, you know, how the hell did that happen?
Yes.
Because we're living with the effects every day. I mean, how much more efficient
mm-hmm.
our daily conversations would be, and how much more boring social media would be if this lack of clarity on both sides didn't exist.
Yes.
But a serious point, were there particular things that people seized onto early on? Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, no, I think I mentioned a couple of them with the kind of social Darwinism came along right away.
Yeah.
See, aha, it's very easy for you and mine to jump from off. That's what we're saying about animals here, what we can say about humans. But also, we've explained a central thing, how is there a design in nature, and he's done it without God, so ergo, we don't need God anymore. But, I mean, I didn't include it, but Darwin himself jumps on the bandwagon rather fast, you know, in his own interpretation of his theory. So it's not just other nasty people that are interpreting him. In his Descent of Man, he includes his cousin, Frances Galton's theory of eugenics and Herbert Spencer's social Darwinism. Let's see here. Darwin himself writes, a most important obstacle in civilized countries to an increase in the number of men of superior class is the tendency of societies very poor and reckless, who are often degraded by vice, to increase faster than the provident and generally virtuous members. So there is competition, free trade, imperialism, racial extermination, sexual inequality are seen to be written in, if you read it a certain way, from the start. So I've been talking about theory of evolution in its pure, empirical, scientific. But we're human beings. So we don't separate things out that clearly. So if it did get confused, it was confused from the get-go, and now we try to sort it out. But I think there is a way of sorting out the science of evolution from its accretions, but it's not easy because they're there right from the start.
I think that's all we have time for tonight. One more round of applause for our speaker.